You can identify mutations in patients. You can go in and edit that gene and replace it functionally with the mutated gene, and then do whatever like characterizing you want to figure out like what exactly effect is that mutation having in your mouse model. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of In Plain English. I am your host, Jamie Moffa, and today I am also the expert presenter, and I'm going to be talking about a preprint paper that I just published called Cell-Specific Single Viral Vector CRISPR-Cas9 Editing and Genetically Encoded Tool Delivery in the Central and Peripheral Nervous Systems. I want to highlight at the outset that this is still a preprint. It hasn't gone through peer review. It's in that process now, but I thought it would be good to get it out there and talk a little bit about gene editing. So here with me today are our guests, Dongyu Kim and Priv. So would you each like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Dongyu Kim. I am a second year graduate student with the Plant and Microbial Biosciences program here at the Washington University. I'll be honest, I work primarily with microbes. So doing a crash course on neurobiology was quite the gargantuan task, but I'm excited to discuss science all the same.
Hi, I'm Rachel Privet. I go by Priv for short. I am a physical therapist. I work in a medical ICU. So pretty far removed from this research. So pretty excited to learn more.
Awesome. Well, so yeah, I think to start off, I kind of wanted to back up from the fancy CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing and give a little bit of a background of the ways that we have done gene editing in mice thus far, because it didn't start with CRISPR. CRISPR is kind of the new kid on the block when it comes to how we delete and modify genes in lab animals. So kind of the most basic type of gene editing that we can do in mice is called a global knockout. So that's basically you take a embryo that's just one cell. It's still at that one cell stage. It hasn't divided. And you get rid of your gene of interest in that one cell. And then as the cell divides, literally no cell in that whole animal will ever have that gene. And that was kind of the first way that we did gene knockout or gene deletion studies. And that was really useful. You can learn a lot about different genes that way. But it's really not very specific. You are knocking out this gene literally everywhere, which sometimes, if you're knocking out a particularly important gene, can be lethal. And then you don't have an alive animal to study your gene in. But even if they do survive, let's say you wanted to study gene X in the brain, you've just knocked it out in everywhere. So it's kind of difficult to separate out the effects of like knocking out gene X in the brain versus knocking out gene X everywhere else. The way that researchers kind of address this problem is by introducing what's called the Cre-LOX gene knockout system. So what that is, LOX sites are not fish. They are little just stretches of DNA like recognition sequences that you can put around your gene of interest. And then Cre is a protein that recognizes those LOX sites and cuts out whatever is in between them. So you can go in to a mouse and you can put these little LOX sequences around your gene of interest and then have Cre cut out that gene. This allows more specificity because one of the things you can do with that Cre protein is you can make it be expressed in a particular kind of tissue. So you can make it just be expressed in the brain or just expressed in the skin or just expressed in the gut or whatever. So you can get much more specific with the type of cell that you're knocking out gene X in. But you can still run into problems because let's say you're like, okay, I'm going to knock out gene X in neurons. That still knocks out gene X in all neurons. And maybe you're interested only in gene X in like the brainstem, the like very base of the brain. So to do that, what you can do instead of having Cre, the like protein that's going to cut out that gene in the animal, in what I was just talking about, like it was literally in the genome of the animal, you can instead inject it into a specific part of the brain using a virus. Now, usually viruses, you know, they're bad for people. You know, COVID is a virus, the flu is a virus, the cold is a virus, or many viruses. But at their core, viruses are just gene delivery tools. They are an envelope of proteins that are good at getting into specific types of cells. And inside, they have genetic material, and they make the cell make the genetic material. So we can harness that to make cells make this Cre protein that's going to knock out our gene of interest. So you can take that, you can inject it into whatever part of the brain you want, because I'm a neuroscientist. You can obviously do this in things that are not the brain, but that's not what I do. So you can inject it into whatever part of the brain you want. And because, also importantly, these viruses can't replicate, your expression of that protein that's going to knock out your gene, the Cre, is in only one part of the brain. And what's cool about viruses is because they're just genetic information delivery tools, you can put other genetic information in there too. So let's say you want to see the cells that you've knocked out your gene in. You can put in the genetic code for a fluorescent protein, kind of like, you know, the proteins that make fireflies glow or some jellyfish glow. You can put in that kind of protein into your virus. And so now you have a small set of cells that glow and have knocked out the gene of interest. And so that's really helpful. You can also put more complicated marker proteins like we'll talk about. You can put in proteins that will let you keep track of the neuron's activity. Neurons kind of spike, and that's how they send signals. And so you can keep track of their activity. You can put in proteins that help control neurons' activity. So there's a lot you can do with viruses. But even the Cre-LOX system that we've been talking about has its drawbacks. And kind of the principal one is that you need to make a new mouse line. You still need to make a mouse line, even with the virus injection version, that has those LOX recognition sites around your gene of interest. So let's say you want to study a new gene that no one's ever studied before, and you don't know what it does. You think maybe, like, you know, there was a study in humans where they like did whole genome sequencing in humans. They're like, maybe this gene is associated with like Alzheimer's. I don't know. And so you want to study it, but you have to go make a whole new mouse line and then wait for that mouse line, like those mice, to mature, and then inject the virus and wait for the virus to express and then do whatever studies you're going to do. And maybe you do all of that and spend all of that time and money only to find out that this gene doesn't do anything. So that gets really cost prohibitive when you want to study a lot of potential genes that might do something, but you don't know yet. That's kind of finally where CRISPR comes in. CRISPR, it's often written as CRISPR/Cas9, harnesses these really cool proteins that bacteria make called Cas9 proteins. And effectively what these proteins do is they're like molecular scissors. They zip around through the genome. And if you give them a little teeny tiny sequence of guide RNA, it's like 20 bases long. It's really, 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 really small. That is one of the sequences that's in your gene of interest. The Cas9 protein will combine with that guide RNA and zip around the genome. And when the guide RNA finds the part of the genome that it matches in your gene of interest, the Cas9 will stop and it'll make a cut there. And it only makes one cut. It's not like the Cre-LOX system where you have to make two cuts. But what you can do with this, and what I did with this in my paper, is if you make that cut early enough in a gene, it turns out that our cells are really bad at fixing the, like, it breaks the, like, your DNA has two strands and it breaks both strands. And our cells are really, really bad at fixing a break through both strands of your DNA. And so it'll put in, you know, it'll add a base, it'll delete a base. It'll basically like muck up the entire rest of the gene. So now you no longer have a functioning gene, and you won't make functioning protein.
How do they breed like these new mice lines that have LOX in it, like at the spot that they want it, you know?
That's kind of out of my area of expertise, but effectively, like, they have to put in the LOX sites in like that embryo stage, the like one cell embryo. And then you basically have to wait for those mice to grow up. and then genotype them, because, you know, doing anything with like molecular stuff is really random. And so maybe you inserted lock sites in one of the copies of the gene. Maybe you inserted it in both. Maybe you didn't insert it in any. So you have to genotype those mice to see which ones actually have that insert. And then sometimes, like, especially when you're doing that, the first type of Cre lock strategy I was talking about, where you have the Cre in a specific cell type and the lock sites around your gene of interest, those are two mice lines that you have to then breed together. And you don't just have to breed them together. You have to actually breed their offspring together, because you will have two copies of every gene. And so if you breed this Cre mouse line that has two copies of Cre together with this Lox mouse line that has two copies of Lox, the offspring are going to have one copy of Cre and one copy of the Lox, and the other genes will be like wild type. And so then you have to breed those animals with one copy each together, and then a quarter of their offspring will have the all of the things in the right places. So you can see how that like breeding gets really complicated.
Yeah, that seems like it would add up pretty quickly.
Well, while we're still talking about the experimental approach, for the lack of a better term here, you brought up viral vectors for genetic engineering. I'm not too familiar, and maybe I'm jumping ahead of too many steps, but is there a particular reason that you chose the vector that you did for this system in particular? Are there other viral vector options out there in that are relevant in your biology?
Yeah. So to kind of fill in the gaps for the audience, the type of virus that I chose is called an adeno-associated virus, or AAV for short, and I'll probably be saying AAV a lot. And the important things to know about the adeno-associated viruses are that, one, they're pretty safe for humans because it can't infect you unless there's also another virus called an adenovirus involved. So that helps make it safe for humans. Also, like I said, these viruses can't replicate. So even if you did get some in you, it wouldn't be able to spread very far. And importantly, when you put it into mice, it doesn't cause a big reaction. So, you know, viruses, our bodies don't like having viruses in them. Mice's bodies don't like having viruses in them either. But researchers have found out that these AAVs don't really generate a big immune response. And so when you inject it into the brain, you don't get that much inflammation. And as you can imagine, if you're trying to study, especially if you're trying to study mouse behavior after you inject a virus, you don't want a lot of inflammation in the brain, because that might affect the behavior that you're studying. There is like the other major virus that's used for delivering this kind of genetic material is called lentivirus. The advantages of lentivirus is that you can put a lot more genetic material inside of them. And that'll actually become relevant in a moment. But the drawback of lentivirus is that it does generate a very, very, very big immune response. And so you always have to take that into account when you're injecting mice with lentivirus, is that there's going to be some aspect of like inflammation that's affecting whatever it is that you're studying on top of the actual like gene knockout. The other cool thing about AAVs, while I'm on this, is that people have actually developed many different serotypes of AAVs, and that's kind of just little modifications that make them better at, you know, getting into particular tissues. So people have made these like different variants on AAVs that might be better at infecting a particular type of neuron, or they might be better at infecting the gut if the person is studying the gut, or they might, this one's really cool, they might be able to travel backwards along neurons, which has really cool applications in neuroscience. If you want to study like a connection that is upstream of the like cell that you're looking at, then you can inject a type of AAV virus that goes backwards, and you can look at, you know, where did that connection come from? What's it doing? All that kind of stuff. So I guess picking up now with like what I actually did in this paper, I'm obviously not the first person to use CRISPR-Cas9. It's kind of been over the past decade, it's really been gaining momentum as a flexible tool for gene editing, and people have used it for all sorts of things. But talking about gene knockout, the like immediate predecessor to my work was work by people in the lab of Larry Zweifel. And what they did was they had two viruses. They had one virus to inject the Cas9 that's going to be the scissors that make that cut in the DNA. And they had another virus to inject the guide that's going to direct the Cas9 to where to go, plus one of those marker genes. So the like fluorescent proteins that make the cells glow, or the proteins you can use to track the cell's activity, or the proteins you can use to like direct the cell's activity. They had a separate virus that had the guide and that like marker gene inside of it. Now, why did they have to do this? I actually was just talking about it. AAVs have a pretty small capacity of how much genetic information they can carry. And Cas9, the molecular scissors that are going to make that cut in the DNA, is very big. It's actually so big that there's only a couple of types of Cas9 like gene that can even fit inside of an AAV. People had to modify it and cut it down to like its very bare bones in order to get it to fit inside one of these viral vectors. And that didn't leave any room for these marker genes or even to have the guide RNA in that vector. So you had to have that one vector on its own and then a whole separate vector to introduce the guide and the marker gene. And this works. Like, you can do it. People co-inject viruses all the time. But a huge drawback is that, like, obviously the efficiency of both of these viruses in getting into the cells that you want is never going to be 100%. And so when you have two viruses, now you're compounding that efficiency. You're going to have some neurons that are edited but don't have the marker gene. And you're going to have some neurons that have the marker gene but are not edited. And that gets really important when the marker gene is helping you study what your gene editing did. All of a sudden you're looking at a fluorescent neuron, you're saying like, yep, this neuron should be edited, but it's not. So you're getting some amount of like variability in your data that is avoidable if you only had to inject a single virus. The other reason why you might want to inject only a single virus is to be able to do gene editing in the peripheral nervous system. So you have your central nervous system, that's your brain and your spinal cord, and your peripheral nervous system is all of the nerves that are out here in the rest of your body. And in order to, you can edit all of the nerves that are out here in the rest of your body, but you need to inject the virus systemically into the whole body. And you need a lot more of it to do that. And when you have to inject two viruses, that's a lot of money, honestly, just to do one gene editing experiment. You're using like, you know, 100 times the amount of virus that you're using if you're just injecting it into the brain, and you're pushing it through the entire mouse's body only to get like editing in this small area. So it'd be great to be able to use just a single virus in order to do that. So that's kind of where my work came in. What we did was, instead of having the Cas9, the actual gene editing protein, be introduced through a virus, we put it into the mouse. We had a mouse that expresses Cas9, and we actually bring back Cre to kind of direct where Cas9 is expressed. We have Cas9, and its expression is determined by a separate mouse line. We cross the two together that has Cre only in a specific type of neuron. And the good thing about this is you only need, remember how I was saying before, like you would need to cross those mice like twice in order to get the mice you need for this, because you only need there to be some Cas9 floating around. You can have mice that just have one copy of Cas9. So you cross together two mice. One has the Cas9, one has the Cre that determines like the cell type specificity. You get the first generation of mice and you can use those right away. So it's much, much faster already. So now you have Cas9 in only the types of neurons that you want it to be in. And then you inject a virus vector that has the guide RNA that's going to direct Cas9, and it has the marker gene that's going to let you see or manipulate or record your edited neurons. And so you can inject that one virus into the mouse. It will edit in only the cells that have the Cas9, and then about a month later, you can do your experiments.
So what does it do to the mice, like having Cas9 in there the whole time.
I was curious about that too, actually.
So the cool thing is that, you know, a key part of this is that we have control mice where we inject a guide that doesn't work. And the cool thing about this is that if Cas9 doesn't have a guide RNA with it, and then if it has a guide RNA but can't find a place to cut, it just doesn't do anything. So you've got like an extra protein bonking around in your cell.
So you said that Cas9 with the guide RNA cuts the gene. So if it cuts, like, does it affect things, I guess, downstream of where it cuts? And so how does that make sense? Like,
how does it do the editing, or how does it like not mess up the whole rest of the genome?
Yes. How does it not mess up the whole rest of the genome is what I want to ask.
That's a great question. So this is kind of going to get like deep into genetics, and I'm going to try to explain it. When your genes get made into little messenger RNA molecules that then go get made into proteins, there is a stretch of DNA that's kind of a recognition sequence for the proteins that are going to make that process happen. And every gene has this like start site in it. It is where, you know, it's just telling the little transcribing protein to sit down and go there
and transcribe the gene.
And so wherever those appear, you could get little transcribing proteins going around doing their thing. So you've done your Cas9 editing, you've messed up everything in this one gene that's downstream of this start site. But then later, you have another start site for another gene, and that's still there. It hasn't been touched. It might be one base pair later or earlier than otherwise would have been, but the machinery doesn't care about that. It's just going to sit down on the start site and start making that gene. So basically, you've got a bunch of little go signals all throughout the genome, and wherever those are, you're gonna get, you know, determined by a lot of other stuff, but you're gonna get mRNA and protein made from that.
Yeah, related to CRISPR-Cas9 related concerns, I guess, a lot of the talk around the possible, I guess, shortcomings of the CRISPR-Cas9 system, at least back when it first hit the news, the mainstream news, was talk about off-site targets and Cas9 activity possibly having unintentional nicking activity on sites that you do not want to change. Is genotyping a regular feature in making these CRISPR-Cas9 lines, mouse lines?
Yeah. So that's a great question, and you can definitely get off-target activity. When I was making the guide RNAs, there's actually a whole database that I had to look through, and I had to search, like, okay, I want to make a guide that's in this stretch of DNA. But then this database goes and it looks through all of the rest of the mouse genome, and it says, okay, these guides are like too similar to something else, and so you're going to get something else getting cut. And if that somewhere else, because we have a lot of stuff in our DNA that's like in between genes that, as far as we can tell, doesn't really do a whole lot. There's a lot of research into what it might be doing. But, you know, if you muck it up, it's not going to drastically affect anything about the organism. So you can have off-target activity in one of these like in between areas, and it can be totally fine. But when you're looking for those guide RNAs, you really, really, really want to avoid them being too similar to another coding region of a gene, or too similar to sites that will initiate coding, like those start sites, or like there's things called promoters, which help make transcription more likely. So you want to avoid important parts of the genome and stick to guides that have very low off-target, like, predicted activity. If this were to be applied with humans or on a larger scale, like, yeah, genotyping would have to be, like, really important. If we were ever doing it in humans, like, specifically sequencing through their whole genome, because you don't want to just say, like, this is the stereotypical human genome, and so you're not going to have any off-target activity for you know, this person, because this is the whole human genome. Humans have a lot of like random mutations in their genes. And so what would be totally fine and be a little guide RNA that has no off-target activity for one person might like actually have bad off-target activity in another person. So you would probably have to do whole genome sequencing if you were ever to CRISPR a person. The reason why we don't have to do this for mice is because these mice are all super inbred. They're like basically genetically identical. That's a big caveat when you're using these kinds of mice to study human diseases, because you're like, well, they are just weird. Like, if you think about times when people have been super inbred, it gets weird. So there's some things about these mice that are just weird. But you also don't have to worry about like, well, this mouse might have an off-target site that this mouse doesn't, because they're all the same.
Not to mention the probably a dozen other ways you make sure that this CRISPR genome editing hasn't had like unintentional like changes introduced, like phenotyping and other procedures.
So when you're making the guide RNA and it is too similar, like how do you fix it then? Do you have to like make it longer? Do you have to like shift it? Like,
you just pick a different one. This all works the best when you have a pretty like a decently long stretch of DNA that you're trying to find a guide inside of. So probably about like 300 bases of DNA is like the minimum that I've found will yield really good results. You can still do shorter than that, but it really limits you because you're not just limited by the length of the guide RNA, which is 20 bases of DNA, 20 little nucleotides, which is what DNA is made up of. But you're also limited by like something I didn't mention is that the Cas9 also has little recognition sites, and it will pause there. Even if like the guide doesn't recognize the gene, it'll pause at each of these recognition sites and see like, oh, does this match? Nope, moving on. Does this match? Nope, moving on. Does this match? Nope, moving on. So your guide has to be next to one of those. So you have to have a stretch of DNA that has those recognition sites and that has the 20 base pair guide, and that guide is not too similar. And in a like 300 base pair stretch of DNA, you might get 20 to 50 possible guides. And so you have plenty to choose from. And usually you can avoid having ones that are too similar to other stretches of DNA or ones that are predicted to be less efficient for whatever reason. When you start trying to edit shorter stretches of DNA or like have shorter regions that you're looking into, it can start to get tricky because your options are limited. You know, that's an important caveat of CRISPR-Cas9 is that like it doesn't work perfectly for every gene. Sometimes you just don't have enough to work with. Sometimes like genes can actually have a bunch of different variants. So even though it's the same coming from the same gene, when it becomes that messenger RNA that's going to go get made into a protein, the messenger RNA can actually get cut up and put together in a couple of different ways for a lot of genes. And so if you have a gene where it has a lot of different ways that its messenger RNA can get put together, it can be tricky to find a guide that will get rid of all of them. So I can briefly talk about then how we went about making sure that this worked. And so these were actually like really cool experiments, and they kind of demonstrate a lot of fundamentals of how neuroscience of this type is done. Because we wanted to choose tools and applications that people would be excited about and want to use. So the first one that we did was we wanted to knock out this gene called VGAT. And what VGAT does is it's in neurons, and it's in a specific type of neuron called an inhibitory neuron. And what inhibitory neurons are doing is they're telling all of the other neurons around them that they're connected to be less active, to send less information. And the way they do this in the parts of the brain we were looking at is through this neurotransmitter, this little molecule called GABA. And so at the connections between this inhibitory neuron and its other neurons, it has little packages of GABA called vesicles that it then, when the inhibitory neuron becomes active, it releases the little packages of GABA, which then go and contact the neuron that is connected to the inhibitory neuron, and the GABA makes that neuron less active. And then how the GABA gets into the little packages is through the gene called VGAT. So we wanted to knock out the gene called VGAT so that the neuron couldn't put GABA into the little vesicles. If it can't put GABA into the vesicles, then when it's activated, the neuron will still release the packages, but the packages have no information in them. Then it won't, you know, inhibit the neurons that are connected to it. And you can actually measure that using a really cool technique that's called electrophysiology. And so what you do for that, this is actually wild, and I love telling people about it because it's kind of crazy, is you can actually, you take slices from mouse brains and you put them in, like, the brain is bathed in this stuff called cerebrospinal fluid. It has a whole bunch of like glucose and nutrients in it. So you put the brain slices in fake CSF, and then you can look at the brain slice under a microscope with enough power that you can see the individual neurons, and you can take an electrode and you can use little like micro manipulators, kind of like playing a video game, but for science. And you can move this teeny tiny electrode and put it right down on top of the neurons. And then you can actually record their activity using this teeny tiny electrode. So what we did was we designed a guide RNA to knock out VGAT. So neurons with this would no longer package the GABA into their little packages and would no longer release GABA. We also put into the virus the gene for a protein called Chronos, which is a cool name for a gene. And what it does is it lets you use light to make a neuron active, which is awesome. It kind of works like your eyes. Your eyes are constantly taking in light, and that light is making the neurons in the back of your eyes active. It uses a protein that's similar to that, so that when you shine light on these neurons, it's expressed only in the inhibitory neurons, and then you activate the inhibitory neurons, and you can record from those neurons that the inhibitory neurons are connected to and see if the neurons that the inhibitory neuron is connected to are being inhibited. And if they are, you're like, okay, that's normal, where you expect that. In the edited neurons, what you should see is that they're not being inhibited, that they're still doing their thing. And in fact, that's what we ended up seeing. We had a control group that had a guide RNA that didn't work on purpose. And so we activated the inhibitory neurons, recorded from the neurons they're connected to, and saw a totally normal, like, inhibition. We saw that they were definitely inhibited. And then we recorded from, we had, you know, the active guide RNA in different animals that did, in fact, delete the VGAT gene. So no more GABA. And then we did the same thing. We stimulated those inhibitory neurons, recorded from the neurons they were connected to, and saw a much smaller amount of inhibition. And so, like, that was really robust. We saw it across a lot of different animals. We saw it across a lot of different cells.
I guess as a microbiologist, even if you do introduce a genetic manipulation to what's usually a population of cells, those are actively dividing and growing cells. So to witness CRISPR having an effect on what's essentially a tissue type that's stopped actively dividing. Am I correct in saying this?
Yes, the neurons are not dividing anymore. That's it. They're done.
Right. Yeah, it's impressive, for the lack of a better word, right now.
There's actually, early on in the advent of CRISPR, there was a lot of debate about whether or not it would work in these like terminal cell types. You know, cells that are maximally differentiated, they're done dividing. They're like, that's what that cell is going to be. And actually, it was quite exciting breakthrough when people did start demonstrating gene editing using CRISPR in the nervous system, because they're like, oh, there's actually like processes here that are still going on that allow this to happen. And that was a cool thing that we learned in the process of trying CRISPR in the nervous system, and also means that you can do CRISPR in the nervous system.
Right. Yeah. How pliable or plastic are these sections of the brain that you're injecting these virus vectors into? Can you expect them to, at least at the cellular biological level, like maintain the way that they were originally conceived throughout the life of the the larger organism, or can you expect significant changes in the fundamental biology of these different regions?
From purely a physical standpoint, you are putting about a millimeter wide needle through the brain, which a millimeter is not big on, a people scale, but on a neuron scale, it's pretty big. You can see even when you are looking at the brain tissue of these animals, weeks and months later, you get kind of scarring. You can definitely see where you put the needle to put the virus. But the cool thing about the brain is that it is, you actually said it is very plastic. It's very resilient to damage, and something like that, where it's a very limited amount of damage for a short period of time, the brain can actually recover from that very quickly and remake connections and kind of route around the area of damage. In terms of whether or not they maintain their function on a molecular level after the editing, we didn't do a lot of behavioral quantification in these animals just because it takes a lot longer. But these animals where they had the VGAT knocked out in this part of the brain were broadly normal. We couldn't tell anything different about them. We would have had to do a very large battery of tests to start being able to tell anything different about them. And also, your brain is kind of symmetrical. It's got two sides to it. And especially when you're not talking about the cortex, the most outer part that does a lot of the complex processing, when you're talking about the inner parts, they more or less do the same thing on both sides. So even if you mess something up on one side and that this one side of the brain doesn't have any inhibitory transmission anymore, the other side still does. By and large, animals and people can get by with that. By and large, in order to see a behavioral change, a lot of times people will have to do a kind of gene manipulation on both sides. And actually, we did that in a later experiment because we were maybe going to see behavioral differences. We didn't end up seeing behavioral differences, but we injected on both sides just for funsies, just to find out if it might, affect the mice's behavior at all. We more or less did the same thing in the second experiment as we did in the first experiment. The reason we did it again is because we wanted to have more controls. So in the first experiment, we knocked out this VGAT. We made there not be inhibitory signals from these neurons, and we recorded from downstream neurons. But we activated the inhibitory neurons. You could make the argument that maybe in the edited animals, we just didn't activate as many inhibitory neurons. So when you're recording from their downstream partners, they're going to have a lower inhibitory signal just because you activated fewer of the neurons. And you have really no way to control for that other than doing it a bunch of times. So we were pretty convinced after the first experiment, but we also wanted to do another experiment. So we picked a type of neuron that releases, that sends both excitatory and inhibitory information. So some of its little packages that it sends to its neighbor neurons has glutamate, which is a excitatory neurotransmitter. And so it tells those neurons to be excited. And some of the packages have GABA. And so we only got rid of their ability to package GABA and not glutamate. And then you can make it send an excitatory and make it send an inhibitory signal. And then the excitatory signal shouldn't change between the edited and the control mice because you're not doing anything to any of the proteins that put the glutamate into the packages. But you are still doing something to the VGAT protein that puts the GABA, the inhibitory one, in the vesicles. So you should be able to take the ratio of those two and have a nice internal control to see that, in fact, your editing was what was making there be less of an inhibitory signal and not the fact that you just weren't activating as many cells or that you weren't in the exact same area of the brain or, whatever else that you might say. So it was just a nice double check that we did, in fact, do the thing that we were trying to do.
If people want to use this tool, is it they have to first breed the specific mice? And I guess what is that process? Is there is it something you guys create and then, or do you have all the instructions of how to do it and then people can follow the recipe, or is it something they have to collaborate with someone who's already doing this because they already have the tools?
I mean, so this is actually something that I care about a lot. And one of the reasons I do this podcast is that I care a lot about open science. And so we have all of the instructions on how to do this. In fact, this paper is so darn long because most of it is instructions on how to do it. And I wanted it to be very thorough instructions on how to do it. You can, I hope, just by reading this paper, figure out how to do this. And we've uploaded all of the like viral vectors, the like guide RNA plus marker gene combos. We've uploaded them to a like repository of such vectors. So like, you know, now you can go online and be like, oh, I want to do that same thing. And you can get it from that repository. We don't get any money from that. The repository gets a little bit of money to like prepare it and everything. We're freely sharing that with the neuroscience community so that they can do it too. With the mice, actually, the cool thing is that a lot of these mouse lines are already in existence. The mouse line that has Cas9 in it is already in existence. You can order that. And then the mice that express the like Cre to like be able to express the Cas9, the mice that express the Cre in like specific cell types are also pretty common. And a lot of neuroscience labs will already have the Cre lines that they need to do this. And they just need to get the Cas9 line. Or they can be like, oh, I want to look at gene editing in a totally new type of neuron. So I'm going to make a totally new Cre line, which is an endeavor in and of itself. But they can do that. And then they can take that Cre line and cross it to the Cas line. And bada bing, bada boom, you have animals that you can use for this experiment. So like the idea was that all of this would be like as easy to get as possible and as easy to like replicate as possible. I'm sure people have heard of things called genome-wide association studies, or GWAS. These are huge gene screening panels that look at associations between thousands and thousands of different genes with different like diseases in people. And so one of the like big reasons why we wanted to do this is because you don't want to try to study all those different genes by having to make a new mouse line every time, which is what I was talking about in the beginning. So now you can just make a different guide RNA. Say you've identified 20 genes that might be linked to, I don't know, some like neurodegenerative disorder, like ALS or something. You've discovered 20 genes that might be linked to it. And you want to like see what happens when you knock out each of them. So you can create just these short little stretches of DNA to target each of those different genes. And you can first put them into like cells in a dish and see what it does there. You can then inject them into mice and see what it does there, and kind of narrow down your pool of genes that you're studying that way, as opposed to doing it with new mice every time. So that's like one of the really cool applications of this. I will kind of maybe skip over experiment 3 because it's more of the like electrophysiology just with a different gene. And I'll go to 4, which is actually looking at gene editing in alive mice that are awake and moving around and doing something. So what we did for that, this is where we injected the virus into both sides of the brain to see if maybe the mice would do something different. We knocked out a receptor in these neurons that, you know, so I was talking before about the neurotransmitters that are sending the information. This receptor is receiving that information. And it's receiving the information that's telling it to be excited. So we knocked out this receptor that's telling these neurons to be excited. So now they can't receive excitatory signals from neurons that are connected to them. And these neurons are in a like reward center of the brain. They release a thing called dopamine, which you might have heard of, which kind of is related to, you know, experiencing pleasurable things or like being interested in or like curious about something. We knocked out the ability for these neurons to like become excited by other neurons. And we expressed a protein called GCAMP, which is also a fun name for a gene, which allows you to track their activity. And so normally, and then we had these mice, we put a little fiber in their head because the GCAMP protein becomes like more luminescent. It glows brighter when the neurons are more active. So then you can put a little like fiber optic into their head and record the signal on a computer while they're doing something. And what we had these mice do was a really basic task where they heard a tone and then they got a food pellet. And that kind of repeated as many times as the mice wanted to do the trial. It was just very basic. Hear a tone, get a food pellet. Hear a tone, get a food pellet. We wanted to see. Normally, these neurons should become excited. They should have more activity and the G-camp should be like brighter when they hear the tone and when they get the food pellet, because the tone is predicting the food pellet and then the food pellet is tasty and they like it. And so in the control animals that had a guide that didn't work, that was exactly what we saw, especially in response to the food pellet. These neurons were like crazy. They were like, heck yeah, this is my thing. I'm so excited. I'm releasing so much dopamine. Like, we love food. And in the mice that had the receptor edited, so they couldn't get like inputs telling these neurons to be excited, we saw that that response was very blunted, that like these neurons really weren't as active. And so you saw lower fluorescence, lower activity from the neurons. But interestingly, no difference in behavior. They all still went and got just as many food pellets. They all like engaged with the task just as much.
Yeah, I was about to ask if there are other dimensions or variables to maybe the reward signaling network, I guess, in the brain that might explain these results.
Oh, yeah. The like reward network in the brain is very complicated and involves a lot of different parts. So in a way, you know, it might not actually be that surprising that we blunted the activity of these neurons and the mice still respond exactly the same to reward, because there's tons of other areas that are responding the same way to reward. And, you know, maybe there's a different kind. So like this is what's called like Pavlovian training. It's Pavlov's dog, you know, ring the bell. It's literally ring the bell, get the food. But the mouse doesn't have to do anything. The tone happens. The food is dispensed. The only thing the mouse has to do is go over and get the food. It could be possible, for example, that a different kind of reward learning might be impacted by this manipulation. So there are some types of reward tasks that are called operant reward learning, where the mouse has to, for example, learn to press a lever to get a food. That's not passive. They're not just hearing a tone and associating that with food. They have to learn to go do something and also have the motivation to do it. So in that, there's two dimensions. There's the learning and the motivation. And these neurons, maybe, I don't know, have more of an impact on the learning side of it, where the mouse won't learn to go press the lever. Or it might have more of an impact on the motivation side of it. Like maybe the food isn't as exciting because these neurons aren't releasing all of their good dopamine into the rest of the brain. And so the mouse just isn't willing to go press that lever, even though it knows that pressing the lever will give it food. That would be a cool like future direction for people to probe into, like, what are these neurons actually doing with respect to reward? And are there types of learning or reward related activity that are different when you blunt their activity by removing this receptor, as opposed to, you know, when they're fully intact?
How inconvenient that you can't just administer a questionnaire to these mice after, you know, your behavioral experiments.
That is actually the main thing that our lab studies is actually pain. And so, you know, my plan with these vectors is to like knock out the opioid receptors that are in your brain in a like specific type of in a specific part of the brain stem, and see how that affects mouse pain. But yeah, you can't just ask the mice, are you in pain?
Maybe while we're on the topic of future directions, is doing these CRISPR edits one on top of the other in possibly different areas of the brain or nervous system as a whole something you've considered?
Oh, yeah. So editing multiple different genes?
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that is like definitely something that we've considered and something that would be really cool, because genes don't act independently of one another. They have interactions. And so what might work to, say, like treat a particular disease is not editing one gene, but affecting a whole like pathway or a whole like suite of genes that are all controlling small parts of, you know, whatever it is that you're looking at. Yeah, for sure. And so like a cool future direction would be able to be putting actually multiple of these guide RNAs into the same vector. You can kind of like we've been looking into ways to kind of chain them next to each other. So you could put a whole block of them in and then.
Right. I imagine it would demystify or at least make things a little less complex if like a multiple components of a system are knocked out. I guess that depends on whether the mouse neurobiology is healthy after however many knockouts of different genes. But
exactly. And it could make it more complex because now you have more variables. And so you also need to do, but you need to do more complicated statistics to figure out what the effect of these gene knockouts is if you have multiple of them on top of each other. Because each of those, right, is like another variable that you need to account for.
I'm just now realizing that all of these knockouts are exactly that, knockouts of the genes of interest in your study, correct?
Yeah.
Are you looking into maybe introducing different alleles of these genes into the mice instead of completely knocking things out?
Yeah. So that's actually something that is of great interest to the field because, you know, as you point out, right, like these genes can get different mutations in them. These are things that can also be identified clinically, like you know, sequence someone's genome and find out that they have a rare mutation in some gene. And you're like, okay, I want to find out what that's doing, so I want to replicate it in a mouse. The thing is, with a lot of these mutations, they're very small. They're like what's called point mutations, so like one base is different. And it turns out that that's actually really hard to do precisely with any kind of gene editing that we have. You know, you can do kind of bigger scale things, but going in and changing one base to a different one, or changing a small number of bases to a different number, to a different like set of bases, is actually pretty difficult. But this technique, and actually this idea, is courtesy of Tanya, who is Priv's partner. So shout out to Tanya, because this was actually an idea that I came up with in collaboration with them, that what you can do instead of trying to make this minute little edit in the gene is you can use the CRISPR to knock out the native gene. And then you can, instead of putting a fluorescent protein or whatever as your marker gene, instead you can put the allele, the exact sequence of the allele that you're interested in studying.
Oh.
And it's a lot easier to synthesize DNA in a specific way than it is to edit existing DNA. So you can think a little outside the box and harness the ability to put extra DNA into this vector that you're already injecting into the mouse to just make that extra DNA the mutation that you want to study.
Just what you want.
Yeah, exactly. You can identify mutations in patients. You can go, I wonder what this is doing at the cellular and molecular level. You can go in and edit that gene and replace it functionally with the mutated gene, and then do whatever like characterizing you want to figure out like what exactly effect is that mutation having on. You can go all the way from like what effect is it having on like the protein folding, the like teeny tiny like minute details of how that protein is folding, all the way up to what is its impact on this like animal's behavior as a whole. So that's probably the application that I'm the most excited about.
What would you say are the big limitations of using this tool?
Yeah, one is one that I've already mentioned, which is that this works best when you have a gene that has one or only a couple of variants that all are relatively similar and share like similar sequences. In that case, it works great. Actually, I was running into this with the opioid receptor, which is what I want to knock out and actually study. And the opioid receptor has like 35 different variants, which is a lot. And they don't all share all of the same different stretches of DNA. So if you were to like knock out one part of the DNA, you know, that part is absent in variants like 5 through 16. So then variants 5 through 16 would be fine. And you've just, you know, not done yourself any favors. Luckily, all of the opioid receptor variants seem to share. There's like one stretch of sequence that they seem to share that's pretty early on. But yeah, that's one of the major limitations, is it doesn't work equally well for all genes. And some genes will just, by their nature, be a lot harder to target with CRISPR because you have to find a way to target all the variants, which is where having multiple guides in the same vector could come in, not necessarily to knock out multiple different genes in this case, but to target multiple different variants of the same gene. So then you wouldn't have to worry about finding the one guide to rule them all. You could find a bunch of different guides instead. Others are that, like, yeah, it does depend on having different, like, transgenic mouse lines, and you really can only do it in mice. We're getting to the point where there are rats that have, like, Cas9 in them, and, like, some different transgenic rat lines, but you need to already have messed around with the genetics of your model organism quite a bit in order to do this. So from, like, a translational standpoint, it needs quite a lot more fiddling before you could do gene therapy with this kind of approach in humans, because humans don't express Cas9. And then I've been reading a little bit about there are some areas of the genome where if you make this, like, double-stranded break with Cas9, it makes that cell a lot more likely to become, like, a cancer cell. And it's, like, very specific hotspots, and there's not a lot of them, but there are enough of them that researchers have found them in the course of doing all this CRISPRing in mice, is that, whoops, sometimes this has really bad downstream effects that we weren't intending. So that's certainly something, again, like, before we start doing any kind of gene therapy in humans, and, you know, even considering all of the other ethics of doing gene therapy in humans, just making sure that it would be safe and making sure that we really know what those spots are that we just can't mess with. Like, no matter how much we want to, like, don't touch it. You're going to make cancer.
But speaking of human applications, how do findings in mice usually translate to healthcare?
Yeah, this is a great question. And I'm going to start with the phrase that one of the, like, very well-respected scientists in my department says all the time, which is, mice are not tiny humans. They're just not. They're different animals. They have a lot of different biology. They're similar enough in enough important ways that we think that we can learn things about, like, the brain, the human brain, from studying the mouse brain. Because, you know, on certain levels, they're actually remarkably similar and have a lot of similar structures. But on other levels, it's a mouse. They have, especially for things where you want to know about social, behavioral, emotional dynamics of, you know, human behavior, human, like, disorders, human health. There's a lot of debate within the field of psychiatry about, like, how to interpret mouse findings about depression, about anxiety, about autism, right? Like, these are very complex disorders that involve a lot of factors in people that are not really, there's not a one-to-one representation in mice. And you can, like, get close. And I'm not saying that, like, there's no place for mouse research in psychiatry. There obviously is, and a lot of, like, good drugs for mental health conditions have been found through mouse research. But you really have to be careful with how you're interpreting it, because, yeah, the mice do different things and have different social structures and are prey animals, whereas humans are pretty, like, you know, evolutionarily predator animals. So, like, there's a lot of biological differences that you have to be aware of. Yeah, just in general, like, I was also talking recently with someone who researches, like, diet and obesity and metabolism. And so I was asking her, like, basically what the comparison was, like, how does she, and she's, like, a MD PhD researcher. So she has a clinic and she does bench research. And so I was like, well, how do these two things inform each other and how similar are they really? And she's like, yeah, we have to be really careful with how we interpret mouse data about diet and metabolism and obesity, because their diets are just fundamentally different from people's. And also getting back to that, like, point about not only are these mice, but they're super inbred mice. So sometimes they have just really weird quirks. She's like, you know, the mice that she works with love high fat diet. Like, and actually, wild type mice that just run around, like, inside your home actually don't like high fat diet. If you try to give high fat diets to like regular house mice. They won't eat it and they prefer like regular chow or even cardboard. That's, you know, really important for her research because she's studying diet and obesity, and knowing that these mice just prefer really fatty foods is important for how that translates to humans, because you can't just say like high fat foods are inherently palatable based off of findings from super inbred mice that just really happen to like high fat foods.
I will say like a tangent along that line, like in physical therapy school, we talked a little bit about like research in mice informing our rehab approach post-stroke. So a lot of like findings about learning and neuroplasticity directly influenced how the approach, like the rehabilitative approach post-stroke was done. And I think it like, it's a good example of like findings in, you know, a mouse model, very, you know, and then of course it was repeated in studies in humans, you know, on a clinical level, but it like came from mouse models and was eventually translated to our approach.
Yeah. Understanding like what the place is for it and having like a nuanced view of like, these can be really helpful for certain things, but it's not always a one-to-one comparison.
When you were going into this study, were there any expectations that you had going in? Like, did this all pan out like exactly the way you envisioned it? Or were there many, like, I guess, like changes or like troubleshooting or acts of nature?
I'm sure you know, as a scientist, that science never happens exactly as you think it's going to. I got really lucky in that the first couple of experiments that I did, the ones with the inhibitory neurons and knocking out their ability to like send that inhibitory information, that all did work out like very much as planned. And so like I got really lucky off the bat. The experiment that held this up, because I've had 90 to 95% of this data since January. And the reason why it is only now getting published in October was the last experiment, which was supposed to be the easiest one. It's like all these other experiments were like activating neurons, we're recording from them in animals that are moving around. Like they're really complicated experiments. And this last one was just supposed to be like, we're going to edit a gene in the peripheral nervous system, and then we're going to see what those neurons look like super, super basic, just like, what do they look like after we knock out this gene? And that ended up being the absolute thorn in our side. First, the type of AAV that infects peripheral neurons turns out to be really hard to make. So it took a number of different tries. We tried it in our hands a couple of times. We gave up. We tried to order it from a Chinese company, and because of COVID restrictions, it got held up in customs for months, not stored in like a super cold freezer like it's supposed to be. So it didn't work. And then we ordered it from them again and like filled out all this customs forms so that it would get through quicker. But then it still didn't work. And then finally, we ordered the virus from a like different virus core that's here in the United States. That's at University of North Carolina. And that finally worked. And so then we injected it into, we wanted to demonstrate, you know, that you could edit at like different time points in development. So we wanted to inject it into adult mice and into like itty bitty baby mice right when they're born, to say like, okay, you know, maybe there's differences in, you know, how this editing happens in adult mice versus baby mice. And so we injected just a ton of it into adult mice because they're much larger. And we ended up wasting all that virus because for whatever reason, it didn't express in the adult mice. We like went to look at, we just put like a red fluorescent protein in there. We went to look at the red fluorescent protein in the spinal cord and there was nothing. We went to look at it in the cell bodies, nothing. Like one in 20 neurons had it. And we're like, what is going on? But then we looked at it in the baby mice and it was super robust. Like all the neurons had it. The infection rate was like 90% or higher. It was like really fantastic. But we needed a larger cohort and we no longer had any virus because we just injected it into all of the adults. So then I had to like remake the plasmid that goes in the virus, resend it to UNC and get it back. And that, like, so all that took just so much time. This like most basic experiment.
It's always the last one.
Right. So yeah, that was kind of like, I was not expecting there to be that many problems with that experiment, but there were. But it's also one of the cooler ones because people actually haven't done CRISPR gene editing with the marker gene expression in the peripheral nervous system before. So this is like, that's sort of the most novel aspect of the paper. It's like, hey, you can do this.
Was there something biologically different fundamentally about the peripheral nervous system that was preventing that?
It's just like I was saying in the beginning, with previous methods, it would have taken two viruses, which a lot of people just decided wasn't worth it. I kind of want to know, like, because, you know, gene editing is a huge topic and CRISPR floats around in the news a lot, even if the news doesn't do a great job of conveying what it is. What are you excited to see from like CRISPR gene editing in the future?
Like anything in science, really, it's not the tool that comes out from the research that excites me or scares me as much as the milieu of the times and the like policies and other factors outside of the laboratory space that really gets me thinking. We've been editing genes inadvertently and unknowingly for the longest time, only over the past like less than a century, right? We really actually deliberately started to make changes to nucleotide sequences for mostly things that would benefit humanity and our well-being, et cetera. So I would hope that things like healthcare, agriculture are where most of these applications go towards, because we can always do better about like being humanitarians and custodians of the environment that we inhabit. At the same time, when I start thinking about like how, well, maybe not so much how much accessible these tools are to various groups, but rather like with our understanding of our biology and the like life as a fundamental concept, like how far can we push advances in not just science, but like societally?
There's definitely a lot like good and bad to think about with that.
Yeah, I think that sums it up. I think what I'm most excited about is seeing it as a tool to better understand the world around us. You know, I think it's awesome. It's insane that we're able to do this as humans and really like just dive in there and get a better idea of what's going on. But I think what's scary about any new tool is we're bringing it into this inequitable system that we live in, you know? So it's like, how are things going to be implemented? And what's that going to mean for everyday people? So lots to be excited about, but always something to be nervous about.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, which why it comes all the way back to science education, right? It's about not just like informing everybody of the wonderful and sometimes terrifying tools that like and knowledge that humans have accrued, but also to be, you know, responsible custodians, I guess, of this like privilege we've been given over so many of the other living things that we cohabitate this planet with.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much both for being here and thank you for your excellent questions. I hope that you all like come away understanding a little bit more about CRISPR gene editing.
Oh, yeah,
absolutely.
Again, thank you both for being here. We have been talking about the paper Cell-Specific Single Viral Vector CRISPR-Cas9 Editing and Genetically Encoded Tool Delivery in the Central and Peripheral Nervous Systems. That is by me, Jamie Moffa, and my wonderful collaborators in the Copitz and Creed labs. Our guests for this episode have been Dongyu Kim and Rachel Privet. Our music is by Sam Brunwasser. You can find more of his work at soundcloud.com/visualsnowbeats. As always, you can download the paper and read the transcriptions at inplainenglishpod.org. And make sure to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Plain English Sci. That's PlainEnglishSci. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you next time for another episode of In Plain English.